Mark chapter 9, verse 30, where we left off. This passage, to me, we're winding down to the last week of ministry of Jesus. I should say the last few weeks. He's going to be finishing up with his ministry in the north. He's going to go down to Jerusalem soon, and he's going to be offering his own life up. That's why he came, to die as that sacrificial lamb laying his life down. In the meantime, however, he's using every opportunity he has to impart to his disciples. His public ministry is largely, it's kind of on the shelf here. It says in verse 30 that they departed from there, passed through Galilee, and he didn't want anyone to know it. So he's not on the main road. He's not on the main route. People can't find him. They're kind of in the back paths through the winding hills there in Galilee secretly, because he is now focusing on imparting to his disciples the things they will need. And in many ways, we're all in process. Those who have trusted Jesus as Lord and Savior, you're called to be a disciple. And what a disciple is, simply, we get the word discipline from it, and that, of course, it's entailed in it. But think in terms of apprenticeship. Have you ever thought of yourself, if you're a believer in Jesus, that you're actually in an apprenticeship from the Lord? Jesus is actually coming alongside. He's going to teach you the trade, if you will, how to walk with him, how to depend upon the Father, how to be an example in a world that is hostile toward God and the things of God. That takes an apprenticeship. That just doesn't happen. You're not going to be an automatic disciple overnight. You've got to really kind of go through the ringers. There's going to be a lot of transformation taking place to learn more about what it means to truly be a disciple. When I was first apprenticed in a trade, my brother-in-law, I was 13 years old, in fact, and he got me started in the drywall taping trade. That proved to be very valuable to me because during the time I wasn't in school, I was able to earn some extra money. And when I went out to California, I started using that to support my needs, and then I could continue to focus on the ministry. When I came out here, I picked it up again, and I supported myself as the church was getting started. It was a great trade and quite lucrative if you were fast and good. And I learned a really good quality of work from my brother-in-law. He apprenticed me. When I first grabbed that compound, we call it mud, you know, in the pan, the big wide knives, and you try to smooth that stuff on the walls and make the walls smooth. At first, most of the compound ended up on me, in my shoes and on the floor, and very little on the walls. It took a lot of practice. But he'd show me how to use the angle of the knife, and the angle had to be just so, and how to smoothly do things and feather the edges. And it was a practice, practice, practice. And in many ways, whatever apprenticeship you would have today in a trade, it would entail a lot of mistakes, a lot of doing it the wrong way, learning how to do it the right way, slowly, bit by bit, you get better. It's true with your walk with the Lord. Do you think that if you just come to the Lord now, okay, that's it, babe, I'm in, bang, I'm right there, signed up for heaven, and now I can just go on about my life? No, you've actually signed up for an apprenticeship. So the disciples now, we actually get to have, we're eavesdropping, if you will, the private conversation Jesus is going to have with his disciples weeks before he's crucified. What are those things that are important? What does he focus on? Like the disciples, we have an opportunity to hang with Jesus here and let him speak to our hearts. So let's take a look. Verse 31, it says, he taught his disciples and said to them, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and after he is killed, he will rise on the third day. Jesus predicts exactly what's going to take place. Now, he acts in this sense just like the Old Testament prophets. They would prophesy of a lot of things to happen, and Jesus did as well. He prophesies about the end of the world and nation and war and famines and pestilences. He predicted a lot of the things in the end times. But if you were living at the time, how would you know what he's saying is true? If I said to you in 1,000 years, this or that's going to happen, how do you test that? Well, what prophets would do is they would, after they give the long prophecies, they would give a short-term prophecy, something in which you could test them, so that if it didn't come to pass, you'd know, okay, I don't have to listen to that guy. He's a false prophet. Jesus spoke of many things in the future, but he also spoke of things that were just about to take place. This was weeks away. He's predicting exactly how it's going to go down. Well, the disciples, of course, verse 32, it says, but they did not understand this saying, and they were afraid to ask Him. I think they could have saved themselves a lot of pain if they had humbled themselves and said, Jesus, we don't really get it. What do you mean crucifixion and or killed and rise from the dead? You know, in their minds, they're thinking Psalm 72, when the Messiah comes and reigns on the earth and the glorious power and victory over the enemies. He's thinking Isaiah 53, when the suffering servant comes and he lays his life down and he's killed, the Messiah. So they didn't understand. They were afraid to ask. And then they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What was it that you disputed among yourselves on the road?" But they kept silent. For on the road, they had disputed among themselves who would be the greatest. Again, they're thinking Psalm 72, glory in the kingdom and my part in the kingdom. And you know what? Mark tells us that they disputed about this. This is a strong word. They were not just discussing it. They weren't just talking about it. They were arguing. I can only imagine what the argument was revolved around or how they put their case forth. I can think of Andrew maybe saying, "Well, I was one of the first disciples, so I know I'm up there." I can picture Philip saying, "Well, I was the guy that brought the little boy with the lunch." And that's when Jesus' ministry really took off, when he fed the 5,000. I can think of Peter saying, "Well, I got the revelation that he's the Messiah." Or James and John saying, "Hey, we were there on the mountain when we saw the transfiguration and the glory. We definitely are up there." So they've all got their arguing positions, worried and preoccupied about themselves. I'm thankful for that, actually. I'm encouraged. These are the apostles. These aren't the bapostles. These are the A-team. And yet they're so preoccupied with themselves, which shows why Jesus has to really impart to them some very important things. And so he does that, as he begins what I would call four crucial discipleship lessons, four crucial things that anyone who names the name of Christ, anyone who says, "I'm a Christian," or a believer, or a follower in Jesus, or a disciple, this should be our model. This should be our point to follow. First thing he targets, and by the way, each one of these things he targets, the quality he wants to instill goes directly against the human nature in all of us. So this is not a painless process as he describes the things that are needed in our lives. And by the way, a lot of times as he addresses these things that I believe are the great dangers to our souls, you understand most people think in terms of sins in a different way. You know, you might think of some scandalous sin being the worst, some sexual, you know, secret or something. But in reality, what Jesus is referring to is envy and jealousy and pride and things that we might think, well, those aren't so bad because everybody does it. And yet just because everybody is like that doesn't mean that's what the Lord wants us to continue in. And really, your yieldedness to Him is going to determine how much He begins to work in you to transform you into the image of His Son. Let's take a look at these lessons. First lesson, what I would call learning to be a servant. Verse 35. He sat down and he called the 12. They're in the house now at Capernaum. They've come from the north. Now they're in this hometown. Right outside the synagogue is where Peter's house was, probably is where they are, where his main base was. It'll be the last time he's going to be there. Now it's kind of a little home group atmosphere. He snuck around. Most of the crowds don't know where he is. He's come into town. He's in the house. And now he begins to call them and said to them, lesson number one, if anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all. Now, depending on how you read that, you might misunderstand that. Some would read that to mean, well, is he saying that we shouldn't want to be first? Actually, no. In fact, Paul, in the epistle to Timothy, his letter to Timothy, said it's an honorable thing to desire to be a bishop or a leader in the church. It's honorable. But ambition isn't honorable. Ambition can be selfish. Well, this is why Jesus essentially isn't saying we shouldn't want to be first. What he's saying is that being first means something quite different than we think. In fact, let's ask the question, who is the first in the kingdom? Come on, that's an easy one. Jesus. Matthew, Jesus said, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for the many. Jesus came to lay his life down. The highest form of the kingdom is love and serving one another. Here's Jesus. He's actually describing himself here to be the servant of all. That's how he saw himself. Listen, when you want to be first as a Christian, as a believer, that's how you begin to see yourself. You are going to be a servant. Now, this corrects the false idea of leadership. Leadership in the world is lording over people, getting control. I control you. And you know, sadly, many people especially misunderstand Christian marriage. When it comes to the husband being the head of the home and the wife is to submit unto her husband, they hear that in the world and the hair in the back of their head, you know, just rises up like, submit? You know, what do you mean, head of the home? Well, listen, when you find out what Jesus is saying in Ephesians 5, it makes perfect sense. He says to the husbands, love your wives. Paul says this, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for it. See, a husband's leadership is leadership by example. It's leadership by laying his life down for the best of his family. A husband who thinks leadership is, I'm in control here, I'm the king of this castle, you know, fetch my slippers. If that's his leadership style, he's not following Jesus. In fact, you know, when you think about that leadership style of the husband, listen, every husband has two different ways he can go with his leadership. He can seek to control, or he can seek to be an influence. Leadership that controls often loses influence. But when you have influence, when you seek to influence, you don't need control. And I think Jesus modeled it perfectly with his disciples. He didn't lord over them. He instructed them. He guided them. He was patient with them. He was gentle and sensitive to where they were and helping them along, seeking to remove the blocks that were hindering them in their life, washing their feet and soothing them. And, you know, I think any leader, that's what you think of. When you see someone stumbling along with a heavy burden, someone's doing something that's difficult for their life, you love them enough to come alongside, wash their feet, soothe their hearts, bring that encouragement. I see myself as that, as any way that I can remove some hindrance to your mind about trusting the Lord, any way that I can encourage you or influence you to believe in the Lord, any way that I can encourage you to take the steps that the Lord wants you to take as a disciple, that's how I'm here to serve. Because I really believe that when you put the Lord first in your life, when you seek Him first, all those things will be added to you. So Jesus wants them to understand this. So being servant of all, first lesson. Second lesson, verse 36. Then he took a little child and set him in the midst of them. And when he had taken him in his arms, he said to them, whoever receives one of these little children in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. You know, Mark gives us an indication that this little child ran up to Jesus. And then Jesus, when it says he took a little child, you know, again, the word took can be like, here, kid, come here, I need you for an illustration. He doesn't do that. The word is actually received. And a better translation would be, he received a little child. That is a little child. Now picture this, there's two things happening here. He's in the home, probably little children there. Maybe toddler age, maybe a little older, maybe 4 or 5. But he's talking to his disciples, and this little one's curious. He comes over, and he comes up to Jesus. And what Jesus doesn't do, excuse me, I'm talking to my disciples, go away, kid. He receives him. It tells me that child felt comfortable enough to come up to Jesus, which is very telling to me about Jesus. Because I can tell you, no child is going to come up to some rough, gruff, stern, austere kind of spiritual leader speaking to his disciples. Come on, I've got to tell you some things, guys. No child's going to want that. But when there's that love and compassion, and you know what I think here especially is important? This is a living illustration. Jesus is saying, look, can you receive a child? Now in society, children, you know, to a parent, they're cute. To others, they could be a nuisance. I have to confess, before I became a believer, I didn't have any place in my heart for children. They annoyed me. And I know why. As I look back, I was so filled with myself, children were competition. I mean, because if I'm in the room, hey, notice me, look at me. But if a little cute little kid comes in the room, now everybody pays attention to the stupid little kid. That's how I looked at it. But you know, when I came to the Lord, I tell you, the love for children just grew. To see these precious little souls, and really, in a sense, Jesus is not just referring, because in that culture, children were just, they were, you know, children to be seen and not heard. In fact, I grew up with that saying many, many times, in the church and at home, children are to be seen and not heard. Shut up, kid, get away from here. And most people are like that toward children, sadly. But when you come to the Lord, you know what? You can't do that. You see children, I look at children now as a bundle of potential, and I realize the influence that I have, the impact I could have in that child, that they could associate Jesus and God and the Bible with someone who loves them and shows them attention and care. That's going to impact their soul. Because I'll tell you what, when growing up, I didn't have that kind of influence. Children were, again, you know, just all I remember is getting yelled at for running around in church. And by the way, let me say this as an exhortation to any leaders and pastors and elders here. If you see little kids running around, look, how you do it is just as important as what you do in trying to restore order. We don't want them to get hurt, obviously, or running up on the stage and hurting themselves on some of this equipment. So obviously there are rules. But how that's done, you know, children, I love seeing children have fun and enjoy their time together in church and don't make it so austere, you know, sit up straight. Stop drooling. You know, listen, you want to make that, you want to have that experience wonderful. And I really believe that's why we have such a wonderful team, children's ministry. We pour into those children. I mean, it's a sacrifice for a lot of people. You know how many people we need to run the children's ministry here to take care of 1,500 kids that come in and out of here each weekend? That is an amazing amount of labor, servants, people that are over there loving your children, teaching your children. We invest in it because Jesus showed us to. But more than that, this is not just children, but because children do represent the least in a society, in most people's eyes. They haven't accomplished anything. They haven't done anything. They haven't deserved anything. But it also, I believe, it's seen value in people that maybe the world has largely discarded. Do you see value in people that don't have what maybe the world would consider marketable qualities? By that, I'm talking about, look, in the world, you'll do well if you have beauty. If you're incredibly handsome or beautiful, the world's going to want to be around you. If you're very intelligent, you know, you can do well. If you're wealthy, you know, it's another marketable quality. If you're powerful or you're strong, those are qualities that we put so much, you know, attention to. In fact, people will size you up all the time. They do. And the sad thing is, we do it sometimes. And the Lord, in a sense, is telling his disciples, don't do that. Don't judge on appearance sake. See this little child? You receive him, you're receiving me. And thus you're receiving him who sent me. You're receiving God the Father. Because that soul, in that person, that the world says, they're not going to amount to anything. That soul, never underestimate the value of a single soul. Jesus didn't. You know how valuable your soul is by what he paid to save your soul. His very own life. And so I think this is a very important picture, realizing that if you're a disciple of Jesus, not only you're a servant of all, but also you've got to be able to have eyes to see beyond what is a person doing right now. You know, maybe someone coming out of drugs or alcohol and their lives are messed up and they've got a lot of rough edges around them. You know, and they just come to church. Listen, if they come around a bunch of stuck-in-the-mud religious people looking at them like, oh, clean up before you come here. What are you doing here? God help us. Because that is exactly what Jesus said not to do. We ought to see in every person. And I think this is true outside the church as well. How we treat people. Do you just treat people if you know they know you go to church and so you got to be a good testimony? Or do you treat people with love and respect and dignity no matter where? Even people we don't agree with. Certainly, you know, we want to protect marriage in this state. But I would never want anyone to interpret that. That we don't care about the homosexual community. That we don't love them, that we don't want the best for them. We don't want them redefining marriage. I don't think they have a right. But at the same time, we don't want to marginalize them. And they're worthy of respect and dignity of people. And God help us if we ever show any animosity and hatred. How you treat people. Jesus modeled it for us. Now, the third lesson, come to verse 38. Not only learning to be a servant and honoring the least, but notice verse 38. John answered him, saying, "Teacher, we saw someone who does not follow us casting out demons in your name. And we forbade him because he didn't follow us." John's probably bringing this point up because Jesus has just addressed about doing things in his name. And he's remembering, hey, we stopped that guy from doing something in your name. Maybe it shocked them that someone outside their group was actually showing some success. I don't think it was professional jealousy. I just think that they thought, well, wait a minute, you can't do that. You're not one of us. I think that inside this situation, there's a lot here. Jesus said, don't forbid him. For no one who works a miracle in my name can soon afterwards speak evil of me. Listen, this man somehow or another has grasped the fact that there's power in the name of Jesus and has believed in him and is actually casting demons out. Now, there are those that might try that don't know the Lord, could have some real trouble. Jesus is saying, if he actually is working a miracle in my name, you can't speak evil of me afterwards, for he who is not against us is on our side. You know, there was an incident in Acts 19, which I think is one of the funniest incidents in the Bible, where these sons of this Jewish priest had observed Paul the Apostle casting demons out of a man. And they thought, wow, that guy's got a cool ministry. We're going to think we'll try that. So they came up to a guy who was demon-possessed, and they said, "We adjure you by Jesus, who Paul preaches, to come out of the man." And the demon spoke through the man to these men. It's the funniest thing in Acts chapter 19. Basically, in verse 15, the evil spirit answered and said, and I'll say it like I think an evil spirit would say it, "Jesus I know, and Paul I know. Who are you?" Now, if I heard that, I'd be a little nervous. Sure enough, the man in whom the spirit was leaped on them and overpowered them, prevailed against them, and they fled out of the house naked and wounded. Don't mess with stuff you don't know what you're doing. But that would be someone that didn't have the power. This man obviously had the power, and Jesus is saying, don't forbid him, for whoever is not against us is on our side. Now, be careful of that statement, because someone might think that means, well, if I'm not against him, then I'm for him. Well, I'm not against Jesus. I'm just indifferent. Wouldn't apply. Later in Matthew chapter 12, verse 30, Jesus actually says something that covers that side. He says, "He who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters." Now, it seems contradictory. He says, on one hand, if you're not against me, you're on our side. And the other says, if you're not gathering with me, if you're not with me, then you're against me. The point is, both of them address different things. You see, if you came into contact with Jesus or Jesus' people, and you could, if you develop no hostility toward them, you're already won to a certain degree. Likewise, if you came into contact with Jesus and the people of God and you form no attachment, you're not really drawn, then that's a sign that you're against him and it will soon be revealed. The Bible tells us that actually we're like a fragrance of Christ, you know, representing to some life to life and others death to death. That is, when you walk in the Lord, there is going to be something that will happen that will influence people one way or the other. And isn't it interesting how polarizing the name Jesus is? I mean, if you tell somebody, you know, "I'm a Buddhist," or "I'm a this," or "I'm a that," it's like no one blinks an eye. As soon as you mention Jesus, people either love it or they hate it. They're either drawn to it or they're repelled by it. Why is that? Because there's something about that name. Very few can remain indifferent. But I think also, beware of that proud spirit. Look, we don't want to be the ones that think, oh, it's our church and we're the ones, and anybody outside our church, they're not doing it right. God help us, don't ever have that proud spirit if you're here at Calvary Old Bridge. God has been merciful to do what he's doing here, but you know, there's a lot of other amazing works out there, not only in the state, but in the nation. And frankly, I was humbled to see some of the work over in Israel and in even there at that little school in the West Bank, I'm amazed the people who are there serving faithfully. In fact, I know people that are serving in Iran, in Iraq, and they can't go around advertising their ministry. They'll be killed. But they're doing the work before the Lord, amazingly. So, learning to be a servant, honoring the least, and now here being gracious to others who aren't with you. But there's a couple of other things on this same subject he covers. Verse 41, he says, "Whoever gives you a cup of water to drink in my name because you belong to Christ, assuredly I say to you, he will by no means lose his reward." That is to say, by use of an illustration, that what it means to not be against him is that you'd actually risk your life to help somebody in his name. To help somebody in his name is very crucial in that time, because to do so, you're identifying with him. Certainly the early church, because of the persecution of Rome, if you even helped a Christian, even give him a glass of water, you could be under the threat of the laws of Rome. And certainly, you know, more and more we're moving toward that trajectory that if you want to stand up for Christianity in the marketplace or, I mean, in the public square, you'll be shot down very quickly. Oh, excuse me, that's the Bible, separation of church and state here. As if you don't have a right to express an opinion. Last time I checked, we're in America. But yet, we see this trajectory moving more and more, that things are offensive. Even saying Merry Christmas, God forbid, might offend somebody. Actually, it doesn't. I think the only people that offends are the media that want to put this thing out there. But most of the Jewish people and Jewish friends I know are quite happy to say Merry Christmas, and I could say Happy Hanukkah to them. It's like not a big deal. But then Jesus goes at the other angle. Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the sea. That's pretty strong language. Millstone is, well, even not knowing what it is, it doesn't sound too good, does it? It's a huge stone that the donkeys would turn on this huge thing to grind the grain and probably weighed 400, 500, 600 pounds. You tie one of those around your neck, you're not going to be able to swim. So, this is a powerful thing. Now, the word stumbling, don't misunderstand that. This isn't just being like he tripped and hurt himself. This is actually more than a temporary setback. This is actually causing one to be trapped so as to lose their life. It's a very serious offense. It would be disregarding the value of this little soul and thus doing spiritual damage. This should be a cause of concern for us. Any laws that get passed endangering the souls of these little ones, because we have a representative government. If you're not representing what you believe should be in the school, to the school boards, in your society with the people that you elect, and laws change that essentially will, like that pastor in Sweden that was put in jail for a month because he preached out of Romans 1 on the sin of homosexuality in hopes to win those that are struggling with that same-sex attraction, to draw them to the gospel that they might be forgiven and free. He was jailed. And more we're seeing this kind of a thing. But listen, more and more too, this stumbling, I think it's a serious offense. There's two ways to stumble somebody, to let them die or to personally do harm. You can be passive at the atrocities that are going on around you in the world. I know some people are taking up the issue of abortion. They have a burden on their heart. That one lady from Planned Parenthood that actually stepped down from her position because she said that, you know, it was a busy day. They had a lot of things going on. The doctor needed her help. She went in to assist, and she's watching on the monitor this little child try his best to fight for his life inside that womb, trying to escape those sharp instruments that were ready to kill him and tear him apart. And it made her, it just totally changed her view when she saw it for what it was. That child's trying to live. That little baby's trying to live, and it knows it's being attacked. And, you know, an amazing picture that hit her. So there are people that run after that cause to try to help young women make better decisions. And listen, I know, I'm not naive to think, look, I know there's a number of women here that have had abortions, your past, whatever it is. And most of you have come to grips with the sin of that, and you've repented of it, and the Lord has forgiven you. But all the more, we want to be influential. If we just step back and say, well, it's a political issue, I don't want to get involved, and don't get in this thing, I think what happens is, in a way, we are causing these little ones to stumble by not rescuing them. Listen, there's two ways to kill someone: let them die or to actively kill them. But if you let somebody, if you sit back and watch somebody die, what's the difference? I think of the human sex trafficking thing in this nation. You know, it's shocking. I don't know how many of you caught some of those specials, but this is growing in our sophisticated technological age. We should know better. We are the purveyors of the most horrific forms of pornography throughout the world, child pornography included, and the human sex slaves, that these people that get addicted, they can't even think of what they're doing. They have no reason or rational thoughts. They just go after that sin. And these little girls that are kidnapped and drugged up, put in these homes and used as slaves. I thank God for people that step out and risk their lives to make a difference. And I know some people in the fellowship, I know I really have a passion for that. And I know others that have a passion. Noemi has talked to me about wanting to make a difference in that. And anybody else in that desire to make a difference, you know what? You can form some societies, some teams together and get more informed on this subject. Man, you can go make a difference. I think that's what Jesus is saying as a disciple. You're either given a cup of cold water, you're risking your life to help somebody, or you're going to be one that's going to be part of the problem. You know, maybe you're thinking, well, I'm not part of the problem. I would never, do that to anybody. You struggle with internet pornography, you're part of the problem. You know, the supply is there just because of the demand. If the demand weren't there, the supply wouldn't be there. And it shows you just how far we've gone. I think there's other ways we can reach out. You know, just loving people. You know, I think of young people investing in their lives. I met a wonderful man in Israel who helps a lot with the Joshua Fund. He was actually Joel Rosenberg's mentor in Syracuse University. He's the chaplain there. And he's got a ministry, International Fellowship. I forget the full name of it, but Dr. T.E. Koshy actually has established this friendship evangelism style. International students, listen, you don't have to be a missionary and go throughout the world. You can be a missionary right here outside these huge universities like Rutgers, for example. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of international students that come. They don't speak the language that well. They're away from their family. They don't have anybody kind of helping them through things. And when Christians step up and say, you know what, I'm going to befriend them. I'm going to love them in the name of the Lord. I'll invite them over for a holiday meal. I'll invite them over for, help them. Maybe they need some transportation. And to develop teams to help these students. You're reaching the world in the name of Christ. I think that's what Jesus is expressing to his disciples. Do you see a trend here? Being a servant, seeing value in the least, and not forbidding someone else that's doing the work, even if it's a cup of cold water, to help them in the name of Christ. I think certainly it goes against our natural human nature, which wants others to serve us and wants to disregard those who can't help us and wants to be suspicious of those who aren't with us. That's human nature. And that's why we need apprenticeship. That's why we need discipleship. We shouldn't be that way. Lord, help us. Transform us. Change us. And then the final lesson, verse 43. That's a pretty powerful one. Jesus said, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. For it's better for you to enter into life maimed rather than having two hands to go to hell into the fire that shall never be quenched, where their worm does not die, and the fire is not quenched. And if your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. For it's better for you to enter life lame rather than having 2 feet to be cast into hell, into the fire that shall never be quenched, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. He's quoting Isaiah 66, verse 24, the very last verse in Isaiah there. And then verse 47, and if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. For it's better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into hell fire, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. You know, the emphasis here is very simple. That's how important it is to avoid sin at all costs. Whatever causes you to sin, whatever drastic measure you have to take in your discipleship training, take it. Now you look at this and you might think, well, that's pretty radical. Come on, cutting off your hand, your foot, would you actually do that? Is he being literal? I would say that if your right hand or your right foot or your right eye actually did cause you to sin, and if I could actually cut out sin of my life by cutting off my hand or my foot or plucking out my eye, sign me up first in line. If I could actually stop sinning by doing that, that would be a deal. The fact is, my eye, my foot, my hand does not cause me to sin. It's an issue of the heart. Notice Jesus says, if your foot, if. See, it can't because it's the heart. But even so, it's a radical statement because if it could, that's how drastic you need to be. Now, if you think that's radical, it's really not. If you got an infection in your foot, ignored it, and then finally, by the time you went to the doctor says, oh, you've got gangrene. We're going to have to amputate. Oh, you're not taking my foot. Well, if I don't take your foot, you're going to die. So you got a choice, life or lose a foot. Which of you are going to say, I don't want to go without a foot, just let me die? No, life is precious. It's always more valuable. Okay, I'll have to make life happen without a foot because I need to live. So this is not as radical as you think. It happens all the time. But what Jesus is expressing, of course, is obviously that is not independent of your heart. Whatever it is that draws you to temptation, he wants you to see it as a disciple. Don't just minimize it. Don't just think, oh, trivialize it. Oh, it's no big deal. Everybody does it. You know, that everybody does it thing? It's amazing how many people rationalize sin with that alone. I learned a good lesson one time. I was going to a sporting event at Michigan State University. Came a little bit late, no parking anywhere. I'd driving around for 20 minutes. And I saw all these cars parked up on the lawn where it was a clear sign that said, you know, don't park on the grass, you know, cars will be towed. But I thought, there's 30 cars here. They must have suspended the rules. So I parked there and a few cars parked after me. So we had a whole line of cars there. When we came out after the sporting event, my car was gone and every other car was gone, towed away. Just because everybody was doing it didn't make it right. I paid the price, learned a valuable lesson. Jesus really wants us to be rescued. He's trying to help us. I think you would say to your children whatever drastic thing you'd have to say to keep them from running out in the street and get hit by a car. You'd have to use drastic measures. If they disobeyed you and willfully broke away from you and was running toward the street, what would you do to stop them? Would you hurt them in order to prevent them from killing themselves? Absolutely, if you had to. If you had to jerk their hand back to save their life, of course. Point is, this, we just don't see sin like God sees it. We think it's no big deal. Our eyes need to be opened. And of course, this picture of hell, worm doesn't die and fire is not quenched. Just to give you a little background, Jesus uses the word in Greek, Gehenna, which actually was derived from the Valley of Hinnom, the Hebrew name for the valley outside Jerusalem, which turned into a dump. And it was constantly filled with garbage burning and the maggots eating, you know, all of the garbage. And it was a perfect emblem for the eternal corruption and eternal torment of hell. You know, I think it comes down to this. It's the great Pascalian wager. You see, every one of you, the direction you live in your life, you're making a bet. You're making a wager. Those of you who believe in God, you're betting that God exists and he's going to reward those who trusted in his son Jesus. Now, the downside, if God doesn't exist, is that you've lived this wonderful life and then you die and you're gone forever. It doesn't exist after that. But in the meantime, you've at least lived a wonderful life. You've been more filled with joy and happiness than you were before when you were living for yourself. And you've also influenced others for good. So that's the downside. The upside is heaven, eternity. Wow. If you wager that God doesn't exist, if you say, well, I don't believe he exists, I'm not going to really worry about it, I'm going to be indifferent to it, you're betting that he doesn't exist. Now, the upside is that you can do whatever you want in this life, which won't make you happier, because it doesn't work that way. The more selfish people are, the more miserly they are, the more inward they are, the more miserable they are. That's your upside. The downside, if you're wrong, and there is a God, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched for eternity. That's a huge wager. Now, here's how he plays out. Wagering for God superdominates wagering against God. Because the worst outcome for those who bet there is a God is at least as good as the best outcome with those who wager that there isn't a God. So, mathematically, it's crazy to assume there is no God. Absolutely nuts. Because the risk is way too high. But that alone is not enough to save you. You've got to come humbly and acknowledge Jesus as Lord and Savior. And then finally, Jesus concludes this in verse 49 and 50, and we'll end with this. He says, "For everyone will be seasoned with fire, and every sacrifice will be seasoned with salt. Salt is good, but if the salt loses its flavor, how will you season it? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another." See how he concluded the beginning remarks, how they were arguing, disputing on the road, with the end statement, look, this discipleship training, you're going to have salt in yourselves, you're going to be at peace with each other. What's he referring to, salt? Well, back in that culture, it would make sense. Salt preserved food. It would kill the bacteria and the germs that would corrupt the food. We have refrigeration, which slows down the corruption almost to a halt, and so therefore you don't use the salt. Well, back then, they salted everything that was going to rot, and it would keep it from rotting, preserve it. We're called the salt of the earth. Christians, you know what? The influence that you have when you use your influence, the way you live, the way you treat people, it permeates through society for good. For someone who lives for themselves, that permeates society for bad. So how you're influencing. When you're salty, that is, you're going to influence for good. Now, he says season with fire and season with salt. Now, the problem is the word fire here is so close to the other use of fire that you could probably get confused here. But there's a big difference between this fire and the other fire. The other fire is a fire that destroys. This fire is a fire that seasons you and preserves you. How does that work? You know, salt has a burning property. When it comes in contact with an infection, it kills the germs. But, you know, before they had these wonderful analgesics and all these other, you know, things that could kind of limit the pain, and you could put some topical painkiller or topical antiseptic on it, and it would kill the germs, and it wouldn't really hurt that much. Before they had that, what do you think they used? Salt. You ever poured salt in a wound? Yeah, that burns. If you don't believe me, next time you get an injury, you got to try it. In fact, when we go to Israel and we go to the Dead Sea, it's like 10 times saltier than the ocean. And it's so salty you can't sink in it. It's really weird. You're kind of top-heavy. You're floating about this far up, and you have to keep your balance. We warn people before we go, that morning, ladies, don't shave your legs. Guys, don't shave your face. You will burn. It does burn. If you don't have any cuts, it feels great. But man, when you have something there, it burns. Now, that will kill the infection, but it's painful. And the idea of being seasoned with fire is a similar picture. Listen, you can ignore God and one day face fires of eternal torment, or you can submit to the Lord in His apprenticeship program, become a disciple, a follower of Jesus, believe what He did for you on the cross pays for your sin, and now you're yielded to His discipleship program, which is going to entail some fiery trials, some brokenness, some rebukes when you're sinning, some discipline, some pain. But that's what it means to truly be changed. Listen, you're not going to have any way to go to the gym and work out without having some measure of discomfort in order to get the achieved goal. Any measure of discomfort you have in eating properly, avoiding those fatty foods and sugary foods, which I'm finding I'm not winning that battle very easily. But listen, I know that there's a price to pay for that. And if I'm going to discipline myself in this, I'll be happier and healthier. You know, the point is this. We need to have some seasoning. And the Lord knows this. He's talked to these disciples about four crucial areas in their life. It's being a servant of all, honoring the least, being gracious to those who are different from you, and avoiding sin at all costs. Huge, huge lessons. But he knows that we need to have the proper seasoning in our lives. The season with salt is like the Word of God in many ways. The Word of God washes us with the water of the Word. And people that are more Christians, when you're reading the Word of God, you don't know what's happening to you, but there's actually, God said His Word would not come back void. It's like the rain that comes down and waters the earth. It's going to produce fruit. And people that have been reading the Bible on a regular basis in this fellowship, you know your life is not the same. There's a transformation taking place. You're getting seasoned. You're becoming salty. And that salt is killing all those germs and all the things that used to stumble you and pull you down and corrupt you. You're seeing power over that. And where the salt isn't there, the Lord will then season with fire. That is, you know, He loves you enough to discipline, to train you, to close doors so that you'll have to seek Him. And sometimes you know for yourself, when you go through a trial and a difficulty and a painful situation, has that not purified your walk with God? Haven't you cried out to Him, God, forgive me, help me, I need your help? And you know what? He's done a fresh work in your soul. I mean, I can't tell you how many people that I see, you know, that are going through divorce or they're, you know, and then they come to church because it's a painful situation, and then the Lord just fills them. And then afterwards, it's amazing. Weeks go by and they go, you know what? I actually, as painful as this is, I am so thankful this all happened, because if this hadn't happened, I would have never discovered Jesus. I would have never discovered the amazing grace of the Lord. I met a guy in Israel like that. His wife was leaving him. And he was just brokenhearted, but he said, Lloyd, I can't even tell you what it's done to change my life. My prayer is alive. My walk with God is there. I wish I'd learned sooner. And I'm hoping that my marriage can still be saved. But if nothing else happens, I'm thankful that I found Jesus and I've yielded my life to Him. Seasoned with fire. He who is greatest in the kingdom is he who loves most. He who loves most is he who serves most. He who serves most will be one who is most fulfilled with the fruit of the Spirit, the love, the joy, the peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. I really want to challenge you. Take a little time to reevaluate. How much time has been spent on self? How much time has been spent on helping others? Serving the Lord? Giving to the Lord? Check your checkbook. Check your giving. Have you truly invested in the kingdom? Have you truly invested in the fellowship that the Lord has brought here to make a difference in your life so that we can make a huge difference in many others' lives? That it can keep going forward to so many others. As you know, we've just scratched the surface in this area. In the Bridging the Gap program, I'm on in, you know, a number of different areas. I, like every other ministry, we're pulling back, we're budgeting wisely because of the economy. But listen, I think every one of us really need to pray. What part do I play in this? Where you put your time, your treasure? Where is your heart? Seek ways to invest in the kingdom. And I pray that the Lord will guide you, grant you that saltiness, that seasoning, that you might be those disciples and discover what that means to truly be the servant of all, seeing yourselves in a way that's so revolutionary different, revolutionarily amazing, what God can do.